Well, please turn in your Bibles to the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis and chapter 18. We've got quite a long reading this evening, but we're going to take up about 1.5 chapters. We're going to start in Genesis 18, though, and start from verse 20 of Genesis 18. The background to what we're about to read is that Abraham has been sitting in the front of his tent when three men have appeared. And he falls down before them and he says, "My Lord." And the word he uses is a word which is usually used for God. So he seems to recognize something divine about certainly one of these figures, who it turns out was in fact the Lord. These three people have come. Abraham has welcomed them into his tent. He's provided food for them. And the Lord has spoken to him, and he's promised Abraham that he will have a son. But then two of the men, it seems men but they're angels, two of them go away towards Sodom, and Abraham is left before the one who is in fact the Lord, the one he had addressed earlier, and he speaks to him, and the Lord says, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do?" And then from verse 20 he begins to explain exactly what he's going to do. So let's start reading then from Genesis chapter 18 and verse 20. "And the Lord said, 'Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know.' And the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before the Lord. And Abraham drew near and said, 'Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked. And that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?' And the Lord said, 'If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes.' And Abraham answered and said, 'Behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes. Peradventure, there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city for lack of 5? And he said, 'If I find there 45, I will not destroy it.' And he spake unto him yet again and said, 'Peradventure, there shall be 40 found there.' And he said, 'I will not do it for 40's sake. And he said unto him, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will seek. Peradventure there shall be 30 found there. And he said, 'I will not do it if I find 30 there.' And he said, 'Behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure there shall be 20 found there.' And he said, 'I will not destroy it for 20's sake. And he said, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, I will speak, yes, but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there.' And he said, 'I will not destroy it for 10's sake.' And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place." We continue into the next chapter. "And there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. And Lot, seeing them, rose to meet them. And he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, 'Behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, unto your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early, and go on your ways.' And they said, 'Nay, but we will abide in the street all night.' And he pressed unto them greatly, and they turned in unto him, and entered into his house, and he made them a feast, and did break unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of Sodom Before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot, and said unto him, Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. And Lot went out at the door unto them, and shut the door after him. And he said, I pray not, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters, which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. And they said, Stand back! And they said again, This one fellow came into sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now we will deal worse with thee than with them. And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them, and shut the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so they wearied themselves to find the door. And the men said unto Lot, Hast thou here any besides, son-in-law, and thy sons, and thy daughters, and whatsoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out, and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, Up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. And he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife, and thy two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him. And they brought him forth, and set him without the city. But it came to pass, when they had brought them forth, that he said, Escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain, except to the escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And Lot said unto them, Oh, not so, my lord. Behold now, thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast shown unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me, and I die. Behold now, this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said unto him, See, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow this city for the which thou hast spoken. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come thither. Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar, and the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and towards all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt. I want to begin this evening by asking you a question. If an angel came to your home, to your place of work, to you when you think there's no one else around to see, if an angel came to you at that time, what would they see? As we come to our passage, this is more or less what happened. God had come down to see what Sodom and the cities of the plain were like. We read it in verse 20 of chapter 18, we read a moment ago. The Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know. God had heard that the cities of the plain were wicked, and he has come to see if this is true. Now, this, of course, isn't because God didn't know, but rather it's because God on this occasion has chosen, as we will see, in a sense, to give them a chance. He's going to inspect. He's going to see how they respond when these angels come to the city. God doesn't go personally. He sends these two angels, appearing as men. You need to remember that as we're reading this. We know they're angels from the beginning of chapter 19, at least. But the men of the city don't know that they're angels. They're just two men who've come in from outside the city. And when these two angels come to Sodom, they find both righteousness and wickedness. And I want us to look at what they found this evening. And I want us to do it by looking at three characters within the narrative here. First of all, the wicked men of Sodom. Secondly, the righteous Lot. That might be a strange thing to call Lot, but we'll see about that in a moment. And then finally, the more righteous one. All the while, of course, keeping in mind that these angels have come to the city to find out if the city is really worthy of judgment. Now, I kind of doubt anyone remembers this, but I have actually preached on this passage before, about 6 years ago. But it's not the same sermon. It is different, although I might come over some of the same themes. I hope that we'll find things for edification, even if you do remember that sermon. It should be fairly different, I think. So first of all then, the wicked men of Sodom. Now there's an ominous opening. The angels come to the city. It's important, we need to keep this in our mind. It's important we remember that the men of the city, the men of Sodom, do not realise that these are angels. They're just two weary wanderers who've come into the city in search of rest and respite. But no one from the city greets them. That's left to Lot, a man who a little bit later on is called one who came to sojourn. He's not one of the natives, if you like. He's not a born and bred Sodom man. No, the inhabitants of the city, they're nowhere to be seen. Now we need to understand something of the culture when we seek to assess this. When a visitor came into a city, it was the responsibility of those within the city to be hospitable to him. To take him in for the night, to provide for him. Now today it's a bit different. If you go down to Staten or somewhere like that, you go to the beach and you might see some people there and you might think to yourself, you know what, I think they're probably not from around here. I think they're probably on holiday. Maybe you can tell from their accent or something. But you could make a reasonable assessment that they'll have sorted out somewhere to stay. That at the end of the day, they're not going to be kind of lying on the streets of Festatum. They've probably got somewhere to stay. They'll have sorted something out on booking.com or TripAdvisor or something. But that wasn't the case here. Visitors would need a place to stay for the night. But there's nothing from the men of the city. Now, we can't be dogmatic on this point, but perhaps in the late light of what unfolds later, this is an omen of what will come. It's an ominous opening, certainly. No one from the city is to be seen to welcome these strangers. But it gets worse than that. Lot, and we'll come on to this on our second point, Lot ends up taking these strangers into his house. And he provides for the meal and so on. But before they've been there too long, certainly before it's late at night, they hear a knock at the door. Perhaps a voice calling to them. And then verse 5, the words, where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. Now, the idea of knowing them, as I'm sure you'll be aware, is a biblical euphemism for sexual relations. What these men want to do is force themselves sexually upon these visitors in Lot's house. And it isn't just a few bad eggs. If you look at verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round. And listen to this, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. This is a seemingly universal thing within the city. These angels have come down to see if these angels have come down to see if Sodom was really as bad as had been reported. And what they witness is a society in which the inhabitants have become so enslaved to their desires that when two new visitors come, they have to have them. And they won't let anything stand in their way. And when Lot comes out and remonstrates with them, they treat him violently. The end of verse 9, and they press sore upon the man, even Lot. And they came near to break the door. Think again of why the angels are here. They've come to see if the city is worthy of God's judgment. And what have they seen? Now they know that they can destroy the city. Now they know that the city really is given over to wickedness. Do you remember Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 2? Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. He's referring back to Lot, among others. But if only the men of Sodom had known these were angels, I'm sure they wouldn't have responded the way they did. They had come, they had taken them unawares to see if they were worthy of judgment, and they saw the men of Sodom at their worst. The men didn't know who these were, and judgment fell. The angels tell Lot in verse 13, we will destroy this place because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of the Lord. And it isn't just an idle threat either. It follows through in verse 24. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. It's a serious matter. But you know, while this is a visit for judgment, there's also coming another visit for judgment. The Bible says that just as God came down here to judge the nations by his two representatives, these angels, so God will come again, Jesus, the Son of God, to judge the world. And even if we don't live to that day, we will nonetheless stand before him when we die, a day when we will give an account of what we have done with our life. And let me ask you again. I asked at the beginning, if an angel came to you, you're at your home when you think there's no one around, what would they see? If God looked at your life, what would he see? Have you, like the men of Sodom, become enslaved to your appetites? Is there something in your life that no one knows about? Something that if an angel came and he saw you, that he would see one worthy of judgment. What would he see? What are you like when there's no one around? Perhaps you think no one knows about it, but God does. And don't distance yourself from this. It is true that the Bible makes it clear that homosexual practice is sinful, and this is the problem, as well as the violence in the passage before us. But this is, we can't just distance ourselves from that and say, well, that's nothing to do with us. Because such sexual sin is always the working out of a bigger and a deeper problem. That's really what Paul's getting at in Romans 1, isn't it? Where he speaks about how it's from idolatry that God then gives people over to these things. And that's not to say that every individual person who's tends towards that particular sin is particularly guilty of idolatry more than anyone else, but the societies which allow things like this to flourish, indeed in which all sexual sin flourishes, are ones where they have ceased to see God's created purpose in the world and rather have begun to see things rather through their own desire. The norms of behaviour which are expected are not the created norms, but rather the norms of I want to do this and this is my own autonomy. It's the same problem Paul speaks about in Romans 1. It's taking the place of the Creator. When we recognise the Creator, we recognise purpose in the world. Purpose between male and female, and therefore the right use of sex. But two, a society which distorts that has already distorted the relationship between the Creator and the creation. It has said, I'm God and I will decide what the purpose of a male and a female is. And you know, we can all be guilty of that. The prophet Ezekiel speaks of the root sin of Sodom, doesn't he? She had pride, fullness of dread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. They had wealth. Isn't that like the West today? But what did Sodom do with their wealth? Instead of bearing in mind the Creator and the purpose for which He had given them those things, instead of that, she used it to glut her own desires. As they say, in the West today, we are wealthy. Even those who are seen as poor in society are, by and large, fairly well off by historical standards. Everybody can, or the vast majority of people at any rate, can afford nice phones, nice televisions, all the rest of it, clothes and all the things that people want. But what do we do with this wealth? Do we view it through the eyes of the Creator? Do we say, what is the purpose of this? Am I a steward of what God has given me to use for His glory? Or do we say, no, instead of viewing the purpose of the Creator, I will view it through myself and through my own desires? Is that you? When you look at your bank balance, what do you see? Do you say, oh yes, money for me? Or do you say, see, the Lord has blessed me. What should I do with this for His glory? That's not to say that you don't buy yourself things and use it wisely in that way, but what do you see? Is it all about you and your desires? Or do you see these things with the eye of the Creator? With an eye to the Creator, to His purpose in creation, not to your own desires? Because if you view the world merely as a means of fulfilling your desires, then like these inhabitants of Sodom, you're heading for judgment. Or perhaps you're managing to still think that this doesn't apply to you. Perhaps we'd better be reminded of what the Bible's assessment of the righteous life is. The only fundamentally righteous life, says the Bible, is one characterized by love to God and love to our neighbour. All else is wickedness. Now let me ask you again, what characterizes your life? Is it love to God? Is that the fountain of all things? Because it's only when we love God and we, as I've said before, when we view creation with an eye to the purpose of the Creator, that we can ever be righteous. All else is sin. God will judge the earth. We sang about that earlier and we said it's a good thing. Evil will not triumph. Well, let me ask you, is your conscience clear before God? If Jesus returned tonight, would you be ready? Jesus told a parable about a man who had left one of his servants in charge of his property. And this power went to the servant's head and he started to abuse his power. He started to beat the servants under him. And he started to drink his master's wine. And he was having a whale of a time. And what would that master do when he returns and he finds what his servant's doing? Well, they'll cast him out. What will God do? Let's ask ourselves this honestly. We look at our own lives. We see what what we have done with the things He's given us. The time we have. The money we have.
Do we use them with an eye to his glory? Or are we like that servant, misusing the things that his master's given him? Oh, it's all for me. Yes, great time.
What do you do with the things that God has given you? Let's go back to the question we asked at the beginning. If angels came to your place of work, like these angels came to Sodom, would they see righteousness? Or would they see a life characterized by sin? But we need to move on, because there's another figure here. We've had the wicked men of Sodom. What about the righteous Lot? Keep in mind again why the angels are here. They've come to see if the city is worthy of judgment. But one man is different. Lot. He's called in the New Testament that righteous man who vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. Now, before we go on, we need to address something, the elephant in the room, as it were. We have to be honest that as we read this passage, and I think we're meant to be like this, actually, as we read this passage, we're meant to be pretty appalled at Lot's behaviour. Particularly at his behaviour in verse 8. When to protect these men in his house, he says, oh, you can have my virgin daughters instead. What kind of a man would behave in such a way? And perhaps our immediate reaction as we read this is to sort of write Lot off. Perhaps we find it difficult to stomach the idea that Lot can be called righteous. Now, on one level, that would be a right response, because what Lot does is pretty appalling. And in no sense is the Bible condoning it. Indeed, the other occasion when this happens in the Bible, in the book of Judges, is in the darkest days of the judges' reigns and rules, when the book of Judges says that every man did that which was right in his own eyes, waiting for the king. But nevertheless, as we read this passage, as we read the structure of this passage, as we shall see, we will see that Lot is demonstrably different than the men of Sodom. And we will discuss Lot's failings later. But for now, let's take this passage, as I believe it's intended to be read. We're not condoning Lot. But seeing that though he had no doubt imbibed probably some of the thoughts of his society, and that's probably what's working out in this behaviour, that he was sufficiently different, that when the angels came, they saw in Lot a righteousness which was not present in the men of Sodom. So let's look at the passage then and see Lot, who was different. And we see this right from the beginning of the chapter, right from the beginning of chapter 19. It's Lot who, seeing strangers, comes out to them and welcomes them into his house. Not the men of Sodom. Now, in the overall passage, particularly including the chapter before, we have an Abraham who was portrayed as being the supremely righteous one, and we'll see more of that in a moment. But actually, as we read through this passage here in chapter 19, we see that actually Lot is portrayed as being very similar to Abraham. These angels, these very angels in fact, accompanied by this divine figure, had come to Abraham earlier in the day. And what happens when we compare the two narratives? Well, when we look at them, we find that Abraham meets them and bows himself to the earth. Verse 1 of chapter 19, that's what Lot does as well. Abraham calls the leader, my Lord, and himself, your servant. Lot, when he has these two men, he calls them my lords, using a related, very similar word, except for one vowel. In terms of the actual letters, it looks the same. He uses a related word, my lords, and he calls himself your servant. Abraham offers to wash the feet of his guests. So does Lot in verse 2. Abraham prepares a special feast, including bread and veal, while Lot also makes a feast and bakes unleavened bread. The fact is, Lot, I don't believe it's an accident. When Moses wrote this, he was deliberately drawing out what Lot had done and showing how it was similar to what Abraham had done. Lot acts in an exemplary manner. He finds strangers and he meets their needs. And he doesn't even know who they are. Remember that these two men don't come in saying, "Oh, we're angels, come to see if the city's worthy of judgment." They don't do that. Lot doesn't know who they are. But he finds strangers, just two men in need as far as he's concerned. Two men in need of rest. And he provides for them. As we're going through the passage, you may have noticed in verse 9 that the men of Sodom, it speaks about how they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, trying to bang down the door to get in to his house. But in verse 3, in the Hebrew, the same phrase is used actually of Lot. But this time it's not he pressed to get into the house to do them harm. Rather, verse 3, he pressed upon them greatly, the same phrase in Hebrew. And they turned in unto him. What a difference. The two, by using the same phrase there, you've got the parallel and contrast between the two. The men of Sodom pressed exceedingly in order to do harm. Lot presses exceedingly in order to do something which is good, in order to help these two men. What a difference between them. There is a marked and noticeable contrast between the men of Sodom and Lot. And it's not just that. But when these men of Sodom come to seek to violate Lot's guest, Lot actually goes out to them. And he shuts the door behind him, closing off his only means of escape. He's gone outside, and instead of sort of peeping his head around the door to make sure everything's completely safe, he goes outside and he shuts the door, and he's trapped. The men of Sodom literally call on him to cause these men to go forth from your house, and Lot instead goes forth himself to protect his guests. With all his faults, and we will come to them, Lot's behaviour is very different from the men of Sodom. He is righteous, while the men of the city are wicked. And here's the important thing. The angels see this, and they deliver him. Verse 10. First of all, in his immediate dire situation, when he's outside and the men are pressing upon him, the angels put forth their hand and pull Lot into the house, and they smite the men of the city blind. And then finally, they bring Lot out of the city. Even in verse 16, when Lot's dawdling and delaying, the angels grab him and they bring him out, they pull him out. Lot is delivered from the city because when the angels come to see if the city is worthy of judgment, remember what Abraham had prayed? That if there are, eventually he got down to 10, if there are 10 righteous in the city, will you spare the city for their sake? Well, there aren't 10 righteous, but there is one righteous. And he is spared along with his family. The angels have seen something different. Now let me ask you again, if an angel visited your home, your place of work, the place where you relax, what would they see? Would they see one who is righteous? Or if they caught you unawares, would they see one whose life is actually characterized by sin? What would they find? Just turn to Matthew chapter 25. Well-known passage. Matthew 25. Verse 34. Jesus is speaking here about when he comes to judge the world. What does he say? Verse 34. Then shall the king say to those on his right hand, "Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you." Why? 35. For I was an hunger, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. But then verse 41. Then will he say unto them on his left hand, "Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels." Why? For I was an hungered and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink, and so on. One of the things that this passage makes clear is that when we stand before God, when you stand before Him when you die, one of the things that Jesus will be interested in is what you've done. Jesus will want to know what you did with His life, with your life. Now, some of you, I hope, well, I kind of hope you trust me a bit, but I also hope that you're thinking to yourself, well, hang on a second, there needs to be a caveat here. Because I'm not saying that it's our works that get us to heaven. I'm not saying that. And it's important that we remember that. But it's also true that those who are true Christians will show a difference in their life. Their life will no longer be characterized by wickedness. It would rather be characterized by righteousness. And when Jesus comes again to stand before us, He will bring up what you've done. And for Lot, He will say, I saw your righteousness in Sodom. Yes, there were failings, and we will come onto them in a moment. But He'll say, I saw your righteousness. I saw the difference. The men of the city wanted to rape the angels. But you brought them in. You put yourself in danger to protect them. You didn't know who they were. What will He say to you? If you're a Christian and it's made no difference to your life, you need to question what that means. We will fail, and we're going to come on to that. But there must be a difference. There must be evidence of God's grace in your life. There was once a married couple, and the wife was very ill. In fact, so ill that she'd almost certainly die. But one day, when her husband came home from work, the wife called to him from a sick bed. And she said to him, I'm better. He said, oh, this is brilliant. This is wonderful. What do you mean? How do you know? He said, I can just feel it within myself. And the doctor was around and he seemed to be saying that I looked a little bit chirpier. I'm better. I can feel it. I'm cured. Well, the husband was overjoyed. But the problem was, she wasn't really any better at all. It was a combination of imagination and wishful thinking, I suppose. But the important thing is that this showed in her actions. Because even though she was saying she was better, when she tried to get out of bed, she'd still be falling on the floor. She didn't have any strength and it didn't get any better. When she tried to eat, she'd still end up throwing up. And it didn't seem to get any better. Because she wasn't really any better at all, no matter what she said or what she thought. And eventually she died. And it's like that with sin. If you're a Christian and God has truly started a work in you, then there will be signs. I'm not saying that the day after you're converted that you'll get up and you'll never sin again. Anyone who tells you that is talking rubbish. But if God has started a work in you, He will change you. It might be slow and you shall fail. But there shall also be change. Now let me ask you again. Are you a Lot? Is there a difference? Put yourself in that situation. Two angels have come to judge the city, the town. Do they see a difference in you as you go about your day-to-day life? Well, we've had the wicked men of Sodom, we've had the righteous Lot, but there's a third one here, the more righteous one. Now, we've said that Lot was righteous, but as we've already intimated earlier, there is a problem with this. Because Lot isn't perfect. I mean, what's he doing living in Sodom anyway? If it's so wicked that God is going to destroy it, why is Lot there? And it's not because he decided he was going to be a missionary to the men of Sodom. If we read back in chapter 13, it's because Abraham selflessly, when he realized there was strife between his herdsmen and Lot's, he selflessly said, Lot, you can choose the area you want to go to, and you can settle there. And Lot looked up, eyes as big as mince pies, and he sees the fertile land near Sodom, and he says, "That's for me. Yeah, Uncle Abraham, you can have that barren desert over there." That's how he ended up here. Even more strikingly in our passages, you say, what's this business with his daughters? You know, if Lot had a duty to protect his guests, which he did, and he realised that, it was right in that, did he not even more have a duty to protect the two daughters that God had entrusted to his care? And then there's other hints in the passage as well. Lot's reluctance to leave the city, so that he almost needs to get dragged out by the angels. Contrast that with Abraham, when God appeared to him in chapter 12 and he says, go and leave this land and I'll show you the land I'll give you. And Abraham got up and went. And then there's also his desire to go to Zoar. Again, the implicit contrast. Earlier we read about Abraham. And what was his prayer? Lord, would you spare Sodom, even if it's for the sake of 10 righteous people within it? What a prayer to pray. But what's Lot's prayer? Oh, will you spare Zoar, because I don't trust you enough to go to the mountains. No, Lot isn't perfect. But incredibly, God sees him as righteous. How can this be? Well, within our passage, there's a hint. We read earlier the precursor to this passage, where Abraham prays that the cities of the plain will be spared if God finds righteous ones within it. Abraham praying for Sodom. Well, then look at verse 29. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. Because here is the answer to that prayer of Abraham. At least part of what's happening when God delivers Lot is that he's remembering Abraham's prayer to him. And specifically here, I think we can say, he's remembering the prayer of one who is more righteous than Lot. We've just seen the contrast between them, haven't we? Now that's not to say that God didn't find Lot righteous in Sodom. He did. We've demonstrated that. Remember that Abraham's prayer was always about those who were righteous in Sodom. If God had gone to Sodom and Lot had been joining in with the rest of them, he would have been spared, Abraham's nephew or not. No, Lot was seen to be different, but nonetheless, it was linked to Abraham's prayer. And specifically, as I say, the prayers of one more righteous than Lot. This idea, it comes up elsewhere in the Bible. In fact, in the next chapter, Abimelech has been really tricked by Abraham, actually, into taking Abraham's wife, Sarah. And because Abraham has said that he's a sister. But then in the next chapter, in Genesis 20, verse 7, what's the answer that God gives to how Abimelech can put this right? Now there, restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet. What? And he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. It's another example of this same idea, the one more righteous praying for the other one. Lot is a failure here, but God discounts the sin, the failure, and only sees the act of righteousness, because one more righteous than Lot had prayed for him. But you know, I hope there are some of you and you're thinking to yourselves, well, okay, I can kind of see that, but Abraham made mistakes as well. Abraham wasn't perfect. And then the Bible, we've just said in that example with Abimelech, it was because Abraham had been telling people something that wasn't true, or at least that was only half true. But here, as we see this one, I think this is an important thing, the one more righteous than Lot. But as we see this, and we see Abraham throughout this episode in his desire for mercy, we see something of the one who is more righteous than Abraham. We see something of the heart of God, and supremely we see something of God as revealed in Jesus. And I make no apology for referring this to Christ. The scriptures testify of me, says Jesus. And that's even here. The fact is that if you're a Christian, there is one in heaven one who has borne your sin, one who came from heaven, though you deserve the wrath that God poured out on Sodom, that wrath fell upon him. And just as Abraham prayed for Lot, so the Bible tells us that Jesus prays for his people. And he does so presenting to God his righteousness. We've spoken about God coming down and judging the world. We've spoken about the fact that God coming down and judging Sodom. We've spoken about Jesus coming to judge the world. But we need to remember the other time when God came down. And he was also mistreated on that occasion. He was despised and rejected. Yet when he found wickedness, rather than judgment, he had mercy. And he died, in fact, for those who were mistreating him. Yes, we see here the judgment of God, but wonderfully we also see the mercy of God. We see the mercy of the one who prays for sinners, who as God looks down and he sees the wickedness in your life and my life, and we will fail. We do fail. Yet when we fail, Jesus says, no, that one is no longer to have wrath poured out upon him because I have died in his place. Can you be comforted by that as you look upon your own sin, upon your own failure? Perhaps you have been discouraged this evening. It's a difficult thing to think about as we think about ourselves and our life and we think of the failure. And I don't want that to minimise the challenge. Let's be challenged by this. But let's also be comforted that there is one more righteous than us who prays. And when we fall, when we fail, he says, no, I have died for that one. I have poured out my blood upon the cross for him. It's wonderfully true that there are these two different but both true things. That on the one hand, if we are the Lord's, he will change us. We will show it by our works. We will show it by our righteousness. Because after all, God has no desire to populate heaven with sinners. No, we've been saved to something different. We've been saved to righteousness. But on the other hand, when we fail, as Lot did here, Lot, oh, he failed horrendously, didn't he? We look at it and we can, if we wanted to, and maybe I hope you didn't think I was doing that earlier. I was really just trying to make the contrast. We could tear Lot apart in these passages. And then later on he commits incest because he's so drunk. We could tear Lot's life apart, but yet when God looked upon him, he said, righteous. And when God looks upon you, he sees one who is righteous. In his mercy, he not only, and this is incredible, he not only washes away the sin by the blood of Christ. He not only puts Christ's righteousness upon us. But and we see this in Matthew 25, as we see it here. Incredibly, he comes and those good works that we've done through his Spirit working within us, those good works that are flawed, that have got mistakes in them, he sees them and he says, those are the works of a righteous man. It's not that they'll get us into heaven. But the Bible does speak about God in some sense seeing our misshapen, our, what we see as filthy rags works. And yet in his mercy he says, I'm going to see that as righteous. Be encouraged by this thing. Be encouraged and be challenged. I'm going to conclude now, but as I do, let me ask you again. If an angel came to your office or to your home, you didn't know who they were, what would they see? Would they see righteousness or wickedness? May I leave you with that question? Well, let's conclude then with our hymn. It's number... No, it's not that one. It's number 806.